Shots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And as the majestic strains of Ludwig von Beethoven's Fifth Symphony tell us, you are listening to Connecting the Dots. We are here today, as we're here every day, Monday through Friday at this hour, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And we're joined today by Deacon Stephen Gradonis. How you doing, Steve? Oh, we seem to have lost Steve. Well, okay, we're fiddling with technology here, but we'll have him on the air soon enough.
Can you hear me?
Oh, now I can hear you.
Okay, I was saying you called me Mister. That's okay. You just have to make it Reverend Mister.
Oh, really?
Okay, yes.
Reverend Mr. Stephen Gradonis. I'll just call you Deacon Steve Gradonis. I'll just call you Steve. You can call me Ray. You can call me Jay. So, how you doing?
I'm good. Getting ready to go away next week.
Ah, yes. Is this your hot date? The home away from home thing with Suzanne?
This is the 25th anniversary trip. Yes, it is.
Fantastic. That sounds really great. I'm going to be gone next week, too. Next Friday and the following Monday, because we're going to go down to the coast. You have to go to the coast to see the Pacific Ocean, because Puget Sound, although technically connected to the Pacific Ocean, is not really the ocean and stuff. So we're going to go down there and do that whole thing, and hope that the Cascadia event does not happen, because if it does, we're all going to die. So that'll be fun.
Okay.
Yeah, so that'll be good.
Well, if we're going to both be away next week, then we're going to have to cram in a lot of content this week.
Let's do that. Let's cram in a lot of content. Speak of the devil. See how they did that? That was pretty clever. You were engaged in a little conversation on Daredevil recently. I thought it might be interesting to discuss that.
Well, there is a conversation that's going to happen tonight, actually.
I'm sorry.
Well, we've talked about Daredevil. But this conversation is happening tonight. If you are anywhere in the New York area, you may want to consider trying to hop down to the Sheen Center, the Fulton J. Sheen Center for Thought and Culture, down on Bleecker Street. It is the place where David DeSerto and I shoot our weekly TV series, Real Faith. And it is a cultural center that, as the name implies, is intended to create a space for discussions about culture, bringing together the Catholic and non-Catholic worlds. So it's meant to engage a broad population of people in Manhattan and in the New York area. Mm-hmm. And the discussion today is going to be about the Netflix TV series Daredevil, which has it's been very popular and very highly regarded. I've only watched a few episodes of it so far myself, but as a fan of the comic book, I heartily approve of what I've seen so far.
They've done a nice job, I must say.
And the guest list is... Did you just say something nice about superheroes, Mark?
Yes, I did.
I'm gonna have to ask our sound engineer to record that and just loop it from time to time.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
We can definitely do that.
Thanks, Ethan.
You both suck.
But the reason that you really want to get to the Sheen Center, if you're in the New York area tonight at 7 o'clock Eastern, is because of the panelists. We have three panelists there to discuss the show, and two of them are from the Marvel and TV world, and one of them is from the world of theology. We have the casting director for Daredevil and another Marvel show, Luke Cage. The Emmy-nominated House of Cards, that's Julie Schubert. We have the director of original programming for Marvel TV, Matthew O'Brien. We also have the Reverend John Cush. And those of you who faithfully watch Real Faith may have seen him show up once or twice to discuss superhero movies and other things. He is at the Pontifical North American College in Rome. He's the academic dean there. He also acted as theological expert for a book on Superman, Superman, the High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Superhero. And he is a huge superhero geek. You and he would get along great, Mark. He's also, as my friend Deacon Greg Condra pointed out, he's also a very entertaining guy, a great raconteur, and it's going to be a fun evening.
That's fun.
The theological resonances of this show, you know, Daredevil's Catholicism is a significant part of the show and has significant roots in the comic book.
Are you moderating this then, or are you just one of the panelists and somebody else is moderating it? I'm not clear.
I imagine that my co-host, David DeSerto, who is the director of film and TV for the Sheen Center, is going to be acting as moderator. I, alas, will not be able to make it because...
I thought you were going to be there. Worse. Okay.
It is. It really stinks. This is the second major film discussion event in New York that I had to bail on this week because we're trying to get away next week.
Okay. Well, then that's all right then. You're excused. That's a pity though. That would have been even richer with you there. So, cool. It is a good show. And I gotta say, you know, speaking of casting, Vince D'Onofrio was really a stroke of genius.
Yes.
That guy is just fantastic as Kingpin. What an amazing character he creates. It's really good.
And I think Charlie Cox does a really nice job as Daredevil, Matt Murdock. He played in There Be Dragons. He played the founder of the of Opus Dei. San Jose Maria Escriba.
Right.
Yeah.
You're stuck on his name. That happens to me sometimes. It's like, yes, that guy with that name, it was a foreign one, I think.
The way I'm trying to go through all of my Opus Dei associations, trying to make his name pop into my head. San Jose Maria Escriba. And he played the part very well. And I talked with him about it. He really reconnected with his Catholic background while he was playing that role. And so he brings that to the part of Matt Murdock. As you know, there was a Daredevil movie 14 or so years ago starring Ben Affleck. And at the time, I said that Matt Damon should have played the part. He immediately went on to play, I think it was actually the same year, wasn't it? That he played Jason Bourne in The Bourne Identity and just totally confirmed what I said.
Well, I got to say, the more I see Matt Damon, the more I think that guy is really good. he's just a good actor. Getting back to Daredevil just briefly, for those who are not familiar with it.
Before we go ahead and we talk about the new Jason Bourne movie.
Right.
That's our segue there.
But I wanted to just get back because some people are not familiar with Daredevil. But one of the things that is interesting, and Marvel does this a lot. They've done it with other characters like Nightcrawler and so forth, is Daredevil takes very seriously the Catholic faith of its central character. Which is handy, of course, because it's the great thing about the Catholic faith is it has all these things that allow you to get inside your character's head. So he's constantly going to the confessional because he kind of divides his life between, you know, being a do-gooding lawyer and going out and beating people up and fighting crime and in often very morally ambiguous situations.
Yes. There's certainly a hero anti-hero dynamic there,
right? And so he spends a lot of time in the confessional, and his priest is a smart. He's a good confessor. He's a smart priest, and he asks smart questions and isn't the kind of, you know, sort of dim-witted Father Mulcahy in MASH, figure of a priest, or, you know, some kind of he's an actual confessor, you know. But it allows you, of course, in the story, in terms of dramatics, it allows you to get inside your character's head and hear what he thinks of himself, and how he speaks the truth of his heart from the inmost inner sanctum of his being. So it's good storytelling. And they do the character justice, and they do the stories justice. So, Daredevil, highly recommend.
Daredevil. It's an interesting example of a kind of a paradoxical superhero paradigm that you see in other characters also, of Nightcrawler, as you mentioned, and Hellboy, of the guardian devil, the righteous avenger who has these hellish associations. Of course, he's right. A man, he's not really a devil, but the storytellers over the years have taken the red costume and the horns and so forth as a way of exploring the dark side of this character. So right. He is working out his own redemption in a sense.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, good stuff. We will be right back. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and you are here today with Stephen Gradonis, and we'll be back in just a jiffy.
Listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Stephen Gradonis. And, we're talking about life, the universe, and everything, but especially life, the universe, and everything that's going on at the movies. And we mentioned before the break, we were talking about Ben Affleck, who played Daredevil, who should really have been played by Matt Damon, because, you know, Daredevil and Damon are like, it's like a pun thing going on there. So that's funny. Well, and now I have cleverly segued right back to Jason Bourne. Isn't that great?
The other reason that I thought that Matt Damon should have played the role is that at least when Frank Miller took over the art duties on Daredevil, and maybe before this, but I know it was true from Miller on, the visual template for the character of Matthew Murdock was a young Robert Redford. When they thought of a young Robert Redford. And at that time, when Matt, in around the early 2000s, people were talking about Matt Damon as having a kind of a certain young Robert Redford vibe. And that was part of what made me really think he could play the part.
Okay.
That's, whereas Ben Affleck, you know, now he's playing Batman, and I think that's much more appropriate for him.
Well, he's got that square jaw going for him. You know,
well, so
that helps.
But 14 years ago, Matt Damon starred in the original Jason Bourne film, The Bourne Identity, and it was a really powerful little film. When I first saw it, I gave it 3 stars and I think a B+. And the longer I lived with it, the more I realized that it kind of wormed its way into my head, and it really had something that kept me from forgetting it. And, you know, back then we had television, and if I was ever flipping through the channels and I saw it, no matter where it was in the, I would just watch it because it had this compulsive quality to it. And they went on to make a couple of sequels. They did a trilogy that I thought had a really nice shape. And the thing that I liked about the Jason Bourne series, and about the first film in particular, but the whole trilogy as a whole, was the idea that it was about a character in really an untenable situation, in which he was trying to take moral responsibility for a life that he didn't remember. And for having been a man who, for whom moral responsibility does not seem to have been high on his list of priorities. And that's a very powerful premise. He lost his memories, of course, in the accident or in the event that that left him floating in the Mediterranean Sea with a couple of bullet holes in his back. But it wasn't just memories. Somehow, the whole way of life that had led him to that position where he had been going to assassinate somebody and wound up not pulling that trigger. When he woke up, he was somebody different, and he wanted to try to do the right thing. That's what he says to Franca Potente, to who plays Maria in that film. He says, "I'm just trying to do the right thing here." And she isn't buying it. She says, "Nobody does the right thing."
Mm-hmm. And yet, he winds up doing it, you know? And of course that brings us to the sequels, but he's, what fascinates me about his character, this has a very personal connection for me. Because
you also were once fished out of the Mediterranean with a couple of bullet holes in your back.
And a highly paid assassin too. My mother had something very strange happen to her years ago. This is around the time our second son was born. My father had died in 1983, and my mom, you know, living alone, was trying to move out of her house and so on. And she had an amnesia fugue. She was at the mall or something.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't really know what caused it or anything, but she simply couldn't remember where she was or anything. She could not. She just suddenly lost her memory. And it was really weird. And so somebody gave her a ride home, and she got home to her house, and she couldn't remember her house. She didn't know, you know, anything, but somebody managed to figure out where she lived. And when she got home, she wanted to talk to a friend of hers, but she couldn't remember her phone number. But when she sat down at the phone, her hand could remember how to dial the number.
Right.
And so she dialed the number from her hand memory, which happens. These things can really happen. So she was able to dial her friend, and her friend was able to come and get her. And then once she got to her friend's house, her friend was able to figure out how to contact us, and we got up there. And it was the strangest thing, but she and I think it was just the stress that she was under. I think her brain just did some weird thing. But I've never forgotten that moment where my mom, not being able to remember her friend's phone number, her hand could remember it. And so the Bourne movies made total sense to me when I watched them, that he could have this profound amnesia, but all of his training is still there. His body remembers things. And I found that fascinating. So anyway... You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
So he has gone through three movies now, and over the course of time, he has recovered reconstructed most of his past. Mm-hmm. He discovered some very disheartening things about himself along the way. But the brain is a funny thing. And, you know, he went into the Mediterranean as one person, and he came out seemingly as somebody else. And what he had to decide was not just who he was, but who he really wanted to be. There's a baptismal resonance in that imagery, the immersion imagery that appears not only at the beginning of the Bourne Identity, but at other points in the series as well, notably at the very end of the last film, The Bourne Ultimatum. People are calling this new film Jason Bourne. They're calling it Bourne Again, but you could say that he was born again a long time ago.
Uh-huh. Born again.
Yeah, well, you know, what are you going to do? It's right there.
Yeah, I know. It was begging to be said. Somebody had to say it, but still, honestly. So I'm not clear what this next movie... I mean, I'll go see it just because it's another Bourne movie and Damon's playing Bourne, so I'll go see it. But it sounds like it's not doing the trick.
It's not, and there are at least two or three different reasons why. First of all, I should say this film does reunite Matt Damon, who, of course, was not in the last so-called Bourne film, the Bourne Legacy, which starred Jeremy Renner. And I think that's why they dropped that Ludlumian style of naming. They didn't call this, you know, the Bourne Resurgence or something.
Oh, that would have been great.
No, they called it Jason Bourne because they wanted to be really sure that people knew that Matt Damon is definitely in this movie.
Okay.
But we catch up with him after.
You know what they could have, called it?
What's
they could have called it Matt Damon is Jason Bourne.
That's even better. Well, and it's funny because, you know, the advertising campaign, the posters and everything, they're just trying to trade on the appeal of the character. The tagline is, you know his name. And every time I see that, I want to say, David Webb.
Wait, what?
Every time I see it, I want to say David Webb because that's his name. His name isn't Jason Bourne.
You know what I want to say?
What's that?
I want to say, look up the number, but that's because I know nerdy old Beatles songs that people don't remember. But anyway. Right.
Yes. You know his name, David Webb. So
that would have been really confusing.
So he's gone off the grid, and when we catch up with him 9 years after the last time we saw him, he's making his living in brutal, illegal street fighting. And that was a disappointment right there. I'm like, really? I mean, you wanted to do the right thing. This is where that's come to, street fighting. Uh-huh. And then somebody from his past, Nicky Parsons, who was played so memorably in the second film, The Bourne Supremacy, by Julia Stiles, and she's in the third film also. Okay. She comes back into his life with new information and kind of brings him back into the story. And what I found watching the movie was two things. First of all, I'm glad that Jason Bourne wants to go straight and take his life in a different direction, but when he has flashbacks of shooting a guy in the head point blank who is wearing a hood over his head, I decided this is not a guy whose world I need to live in anymore. Mm-hmm. And partly that's because of the way that our world has changed in the last decade. Our world has become a more violent place, and public executions and mass violence have become more common than they were in the past. And that affects how I relate to this movie. It's not something that I can divorce myself from.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll continue talking about Jason Bourne after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're here today with Deacon Stephen Gardanis, and we'll be back right after this.
Redbox Media now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
Host Mark Shea, and we're here today with Deacon Stephen Gardanis. We're talking about Jason Bourne. You were saying before the break that the world has changed since Jason was born, so to speak, in public imagination, you know, in the last decade. It's gotten more violent. And so it's harder to watch. You know, you can go on YouTube and you can watch real acts of grotesque violence being, you know, performed on helpless prisoners and so on and so forth. And so it gets harder to watch it in fiction. And I was going to mention, I've kidded a lot in the last couple of weeks about Independence Day. You know, it's the triumph of cinema and so forth. Independence Day is, you know, it's a good popcorn movie. It it goes in one ear and out the other, and then you're done. You know, it's a kind of a candy bar wrapper movie. You watch it and then forget it. But it got a lot less fun after 9/11. I couldn't watch that movie for several years because the scene where the Empire State Building is destroyed by the aliens was just too reminiscent of what we actually witnessed with the Twin Towers. It was too painful to watch. It wasn't fun. I can go back and watch it now, and it doesn't recall that trauma as viscerally as it used to do. But it is true that movies change over time as our perceptions of reality change. Gone with the Wind is a very awkward movie to watch in a lot of ways because the civil rights movement has very rightly changed our perception of relationships between human beings of different colors. It's harder. You just can't watch Gone with the Wind the same way. It's embarrassing. To see that kind of racism that, you know, this was once the most popular movie in the world.
And that kind of contextual response to a movie, it's different with different films and it's different for different people. I can appreciate you having that reaction to Independence Day. It is worth noting that in the wake of 9/11 and the weeks after 9/11, movies including Independence Day and Die Hard actually spiked in rentals.
Really?
From Blockbuster, which was still around back then. And at the time, I thought that was people seeking catharsis from the trauma of what they had experienced by going into a narrative where the bad guys could be defeated.
Right.
But as time went on, and I thought about the problem some more, I realized that part of what made Die Hard so cathartic at that point was precisely that the bad guys were not terrorists. They were just thieves. And that was calculated by the filmmakers to allow the story to be purely entertaining without any real downside of, you know, I mean, people get killed, yes, but
right.
you're not grappling with the heart of evil the way that you are in a movie that has terrorists. And right. Similarly, in Independence Day, you know, the bad guys are unreal. They're aliens.
Right.
Now, part of what makes the Bourne films as powerful as they are is precisely their realism, that they have this gritty, real quality that had not been seen in this kind of action movie before. It had a profound effect, I think, on the reboot of James Bond and Casino Royale. I think without the Bourne identity, there would have been no Casino Royale. But I find that when I go back and I watch the original Bourne trilogy, I can watch them in their context and time. When I sat down to watch the new film, Jason Bourne, this is Jason Bourne today. This isn't Jason Bourne 10 years ago.
Right.
There's a sequence in this film where Bourne is chasing a bad guy down the strip in Las Vegas, and the bad guy is in this 5-ton truck, and he's just plowing through cars, and cars are flying up on both sides, and people are running and screaming, and he crashes into a casino. And this is just 2 weeks after the truck attack in Nice.
Right.
Now, that's an accident, but it's worth bearing in mind that when the filmmakers shot that scene a year ago, they shot it 2 weeks after a woman had gone on a vehicular rampage on the strip in Las Vegas. And they were sufficiently freaked out about that that they almost talked about calling off the scene. They went ahead going, you know, they went ahead with it, but it's that kind of thing. And I realize that it's a coincidence that you can't blame the filmmakers for, but nevertheless, sure. These are the times we live in.
Right. Yeah, and it is. You know, I do sometimes find myself. Years ago, there was a. It was odd. There was a Saturday Night Live comedy sketch where they went to the Dakota Hotel where John Lennon lived. And for some reason or other, it was some comedy sketch, but it was about this visit to this hotel. And it was shortly after this sketch that Mark David Chapman went to the Dakota Hotel and killed John Lennon. And I thought, I wonder, you know, the question arose in my mind, would anybody have known where John Lennon lived if they hadn't done this video thing? And part of me thinks sometimes that, you know, there are people out there who get ideas from, you know, from these sort of creative ways to kill thousands of people that you see in movies. I wonder how many people watch these things and think, I think I could pull that off, you know? And so it worries me sometimes that there's this kind of feedback loop between the violence in our culture and the violence that we manufacture for fun.
And I think that that's also why, you know, having experienced the trauma of the violence of the last few years, and particularly the violence of the last few weeks, there's a feedback loop that affects my response today to Jason Bourne. I think of not necessarily the original trilogy, like I said, because I can bracket that as being set in a different time. But
right.
When I don't want to think that this is what Jason Bourne has come to today. You know, he went through so much, and I'd like to think that he's in a better reality now.
Right.
I also think of Rod Dreher, who I remember writing a column, if I remember this correctly, this was many years ago, but he talks about the birth of his son and how he sat down to watch a Martin Scorsese gangster picture. I think it was Goodfellas. Mm-hmm. And within the opening minutes of the film, there was an active brutality on the screen that just affected him in a way that it had never affected him before. And he turned it off and he said, I never want to watch that movie again. Mm-hmm. And it was something about having become a father and being a mm-hmm. new father and having that baby. It changed the way that he looked at the world. So mm-hmm. the world changes and we change, and what works for us at, you know, a certain point in time doesn't necessarily work at another. And right now I'm at a place where the violence that we see in the world all around us, this is, it weighs on me, and right. and I bring yeah. that to the movies, and I want something different from what this movie's offering.
Well, you know, one thing would be to stop making superhero movies. It's just a thought. Just an idea. It's just, you know, I'm just blue sky in here, just throwing things out. But, you know, you can do what you like. But
I do want to say the whole apocalyptic vibe that it seems like every Marvel superhero movie up until this summer's Captain America Civil War, every movie has to end with epic urban destruction. This right. movie begins with the critique of that, and then it ends with a conflict on a much more personal level. And I really appreciated that. I also really liked the Wolverine, the last Hugh Jackman film back in, I think, 2013, for that reason as well. The violence was on a much more human scale, and, you know, city blocks were not devastated and crowds of people were not killed and so forth. And yeah. I think there have been a lot of comic book stories that have not ended with, you know, slamming you over the head with the destruction of the world. And
right.
I think we need more of that.
I've often thought that that it would be interesting to write a story which, you know, perhaps where the characters think that, you know, that this is all about, you know, some epic salvation of the galaxy kind of story. And then, you know, what it really turns out, of course, is that it's just about rescuing one person's soul. It's not the fate of the world at stake. It's just this one person, you know. I think that would be a stark turnaround for a lot of audiences. But I think that it's some, you know, it was... was it Maimonides said that he who saves a single life saves the world?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this is everything that the gospel is about. that Jesus comes to rescue not the 90 and 9, you know, not the galaxy. He comes to rescue the one. And that's something that's kind of getting overlooked in our recent storytelling, because it's always this gigantic story of, you know, saving the world or the universe or, you know, the multiverse from collapsing in on itself and, you know, in some epic act of destruction. So, yeah.
That was something that I appreciated about. That was something I appreciated about a film that we talked about last week, the new Star Trek movie, Star Trek Beyond, because although it is about, there is a city that's threatened with destruction and so forth, but a very important climactic moment comes down to whether one person will be rescued. And the movie really has a no one gets left behind vibe that after all of the epic destruction in the previous Star Trek reboot films, I really appreciated.
Well, cool. Yeah, I have not yet seen it. I'm still meaning to go see that. It was one of those things I was going to go do with my son. Well, I'll get to it next week. But it's a break for this one, too. And if the dots are still
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Did you just say something nice about superheroes, Mark?
They've done a nice job, I must say. 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 They've done a nice job. They've done a nice job. Okay. Well, you're listening to Connecting the Dots. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gerdanis and our former producer, Ethan Bolin.
Mark, what was that you said about Darren?
Dash, shut up.
Oh, hold on. I've got it right here.
They've done a nice job. So, yes. well, that was disturbing. But, well, you know, I wanted to put in a little word here. Some of us are in mourning this week because... We in this just sucky year of everybody dying, it seems like, which I guess we should kind of get used to because, you know, baby boomers, they're this huge demographic bulge and now they're getting old. So they're going to be dying a lot. I speak as a baby boomer. I don't intend to die real soon, but you just never know about these things. But this week we lost yet another cast member of Babylon 5. Jerry Doyle died suddenly this week. He was the guy who played Michael Garibaldi. For those of you who were fans of Babylon 5, which I regard as one of the greatest science fiction series ever done for television, I tell people that Babylon 5 is what Tolstoy would have written if he'd written for television. It's this huge epic story of galactic war and so on and so forth. And at its best, boy, was it good. And it was a forerunner, I think, for a lot of other kind of giant story arc ideas in which we explore a really big universe. You know, so the original Star Trek series was kind of, each episode was a standalone episode. But with Babylon 5, what it really inaugurated was a story that had, it was planned out from the beginning as a big story arc that was going to sweep from season one all the way to season five. And you'll see the same thing happen with shows like Deep Space Nine or, again, a show that at its best was just unprecedented in its greatness, I think, was the reboot of Battlestar Galactica. Battlestar Galactica owes a lot, I think, to Babylon 5, and so does Deep Space Nine. God have mercy on the soul of Jerry Doyle and grant him eternal rest through Christ our Lord. Amen.
It was an interesting thing about that show. That although the creator, J. Michael Straczynski, was not a believer, it was one of the things that he wanted to accomplish on the show was to take science fiction in a more realistic, less humanitarian, or less utopian direction than it had done in Star Trek. He wanted to acknowledge that human beings, human nature is still human nature in the future. And that included, among other things, a more realistic depiction of mankind's religiosity.
Right.
So, although, as I say, he was not a believer, this was a show in which religion was part of the fabric of society. There was a while where there was a religious order on the station.
Yeah.
We saw a baptism, I think. We saw a confession, last rites, other religion was dealt with in other ways on the show as well. And I thought that was all really interesting. This was something also that Straczynski brought to his run on The Amazing Spider-Man. He wrote Spider-Man for a number of years. That was the last time that I read it. And his Peter Parker had a prayer life. He had a relationship. Oh, yeah. Now, it was a kind of a Job-like prayer life where he would typically have just gotten beat up by some supervillain, and he would say, you know, please God, can we not do that again for a few years, or something like that. Uh-huh. But it was sincere, and I've always appreciated that about his writing.
Yeah, it is. I think there's a particularly great episode that he wrote. I think it's called A Passage Through Gethsemane. And it's about a guy who, a monk. He looks like a Dominican. I mean, he's kind of dressed like a Dominican, but he's a monk with some Catholic order that's aboard the station, and a sweet guy, you know. And then all of a sudden, these weird, messages written in blood start appearing on his wall, and he doesn't know what's going on, and people are sending him, black roses, and he doesn't know what that means. And what it all turns out is that he had been a serial killer, and they had given him a mind wipe. Instead of the death penalty, they inflict the death of personality in the future. So they wipe your mind, and then they give you a new personality. And so it's a nice personality. And so in this case, he had been a serial killer, and they'd made him into this sweet monk. Well, the family of his victim doesn't like that he's not dead, and so they show up on the space station, and their first goal is to awaken his memories so that he'll know who he was and what he'd done, and then they want to kill him. It's a really powerful episode, and it's all about forgiveness and redemption and the choice to start over and repent. It's a lulu of a story.
It really ties in with the themes that we were discussing with regard to Jason Bourne.
Right,
because Jason Bourne is a bad guy who undergoes this trauma, and he wakes up and he's lost his memories, but that's not all that's changed. His personality is different, and this raises a disturbing question. You know, who's the real David Webb? Is it the guy who fell into the drink, or the one who was fished out? The relationship between personality and the body and the brain is a philosophical question that is very, very difficult to answer.
Yeah.
And when we imagine ourselves as naked souls standing before God after death, you know, what you think of as yourself is in some ways much more accidental and much less essential and abstracted from your body than many people sort of naively imagine.
Right. How much of it is brain chemistry? You know, this is one of the reasons that we're told not to judge. You know, I have a friend who is grappling with deep depression right now. How much of that is whatever chemicals are going on there, you know, and how much of our choices are impinged on by that. I'm reading a novel right now, a really good novel by Mike Flynn. It's the second in a series of novels that he writes that are set way in the future, like, you know, 8,000 years in the future. Humanity is spread out across the Orion spiral arm and so forth. And the central character in that novel is someone who ticked off those of name in the last novel. And so they wreaked their vengeance on him and they split his mind into, you know, a bunch of different personalities. And throughout the whole book, the question is who's in charge, you know? how do the different parts of his mind and the different personalities that are at war with him, who's doing the choosing and what's happening there? And he's Flynn is somebody who takes St. Thomas seriously. And so some of these, you know, these different characters are sort of their embodiments of, you know, imagination or appetite or will or intellect and so on and so forth. But there is part of the contention of the novel is that there is an I at the center of that somewhere. Mm-hmm. And the I is the one who decides. And even the character himself, and this goes back to, you know, Jeremiah's observation that the heart is desperately wicked. Who can know it? And Jeremiah's point is, even we can't know. Paul makes the same point in one of his letters. He says, I don't even judge myself. Because at some level, we don't fully grasp who we are. Only God can do that. And so we make our choices, and there is an I there, but at the same time, it's mysterious. We can't fully grasp it. Only God can grasp it.
The next time we talk, we need to talk about the Iron Giant.
Okay.
Because the Iron Giant also raises some of these questions and the relationship between choice and who you are. Okay. And hey, in September it's coming out in a new Blu-ray edition. So
is it?
Oh, yes, well, it is.
That'll be a perfect time to we can talk about that in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
After you've come back from your week of awesomeness with Suzanne,
where you indeed
go and
indeed
have a splendid time.
That'll thank be great. You.
Yeah, it'll be fantastic. We're, we're almost up against the bump here, or the end, I think. But Deacon Stephen Gradonis, I want to thank you for being on the show today. Any final remarks?
Well, you know, it's movies are what I like to talk about, and I'm sorry that they've been so sucky this summer. This has been a uniquely lame year. Not entirely unique, but there's not even one movie this summer that I just really loved. And maybe we need to start talking some more about movies on home video or classics or something else, because this is getting kind of depressing.
Well, we could do that. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we've been talking today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Our producer today was the impish Ethan Olin. And you've been listening to Breadbox Media. We'll be back on Monday with Simca Fisher. Until then, have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Ethan, you don't have anything else, do you?